The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly, where it's our special arts and cultural edition. This week, we're looking at how technology and culture collide. Later in the show, we're back in the studio with Cory Doctorow, author and activist, where we'll be talking about digital rights and the things that make digital storytelling work. Later on, we'll be talking with Blast Theory, Britain's number one interactive performance artists, about their recent installations, one at the Meltdown Music Festival and one at the Hide and Seek Festival, all about social gaming on the South Bank. But first, the main event. Jemima and I have been talking about it for weeks. Yes, our moment is now. We're performing at Glastonbury, making our debut. So sit back, grab a pint of Strumpy, and let the waves of technology wash over you. I'm terrified. I just had 10 minutes in the SingStar booth on my own, singing Common People for the very first time, and it's really, really high. Oh my God, it's really high. I just hope that everybody out there is up for a bit of a sing-song, because if they're not and I have to carry the day, then it's going to be a little bit painful. Right, so I've got 10 minutes before I have to go on this stage. My nerves have receded, which is probably dangerous, but maybe that's because I just went to see Jimmy Cliff at the World Jazz Stage. And I also saw a couple of people doing SingStar before as well, and they looked very cool, so I can only hope that they're gonna make me quite as cool. And I've just found Jemima. And this is Jemima. How
Hello.
Are you?
I'm cider fueled is what I am. Are you lovely?
And you're a pirate as well.
Well, no, I've just been mostly listening to C6 Steve, who was awesome.
How was C6 Steve? He was on the acoustic stage.
Amazing! I just love that dirty, muddy blues. Yeah, it's wicked.
So are you coming on stage with me?
Apparently so. I need to look at the song list.
We're doing Common People by Bob.
No, we can't do that.
Yes, we're doing it.
Can't we do Bonnie Tyler, Total Eclipse of the Heart? Turn around, every now and again I get a little bit tired.
Oh, we've got the fist of power.
To the sound of my tears.
Look at the fist of power.
It's there.
Happy Glastonbury.
Hey!
Right, so we're on in 10 minutes. Jemima's clearly ready, and we'll see what happens in 10 minutes.
Welcome tonight, Barry Peters is here. Don't be nasty, shows your pasty. Don't be shy, shows your pie. Don't be sad, have a laugh. This is the SingStar Sessions here. First up here tonight, Alex and Jemima. Come on, make them feel welcome.
Alex, you've just come off stage.
I feel all right. So what do you think? What did you think of that?
Well, fortunately for me and probably the audience, I couldn't hear anything really, so yeah. So.
I think we sounded awesome.
Sponsored by Addlestone's Cask Conditioned Cider.
No, I think we managed to do quite well. And partially it was because we couldn't see the audience and we couldn't hear what we were doing. We were shuffled off the stage quite quickly because Kate Moss and her gang want to go up there and do the verse.
Do they?
Oh dear. We're being followed by Kate Moss in the game. So I've had a few moments to think and to relax after Jemima and I finished the Glastonbury debut using SingStar and singing Common People. And I have to say it was very much fun. I imagine there's going to be a lot more of this kind of thing in the future as people enjoy themselves into the evening and then decide that they want to storm the stage. And here's a sanctioned way, which is quite good. And if you yourself are ever intending to do something like this, I would highly recommend that you choose a chart topper or something that everybody else can sing along with. Because if you try to do something very deep and meaningful, then you're just going to have a crowd of people who are well on their way to enjoying themselves, just staring at you like you're a giant lemon. So all in all, a very good evening. That was Jemima and I on stage last Friday night on the Queen's Head stage at Glastonbury. Thank you very much. Right, guys, ratings out of 10?
Oh, 11 at least.
Oh, you're too kind, Charles. Corey, your favorite karaoke sing song?
You know, I'm not really a karaoke guy. I'm a singing in the shower guy.
And what do you sing when you sing in the shower?
I tend to make up my own silly lyrics, or I sing old American novelty songs. So I'm a big Alan Sherman, Hello Mudda, Hello Fada, Eat Mrs. Goldfarb. I'm a big fan of Pop Hates the Beatles. My daughter needs a new phonograph. She wore out all the needles. Besides, I broke the old one in half. I hate the Beatles.
Hey!
Yeah. The thing about karaoke is it seems like it's dead-ending, right? I mean, yeah, there's Guitar Hero and so on, but Dance Dance Revolution has gone through some really exciting kind of, you know, which is sort of like dance karaoke, gone through some real exciting iterations. Do you know Dance Dance Immolation?
Mm-hmm. No.
So it's a Burning Man thing. They do Dance Dance Revolution in huge asbestos suits, and when you get a wrong step, a flamethrower drenches you in flame.
that's taking it to
See,
a whole
that would be
new
awesome
level.
Karaoke.
Man, this is turning into a sort of Japanese experience type of reality TV show, isn't it? Well, funnily enough, Guitar Hero is actually going to be performed at the Isle of Wight mm-hmm. Festival. And I have to say, I do think that at slightly misplaced, perhaps as a vocalist myself, but, you know, I don't really want to watch people.
Guitar Hero is a different kettle of fish, isn't it? I mean, that's why I like the drums in Rock Band, but I don't like the guitar. Nobody ever plays does the singing role. All the events I go to, they have Rock Band, somebody tapping away, tap, 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 somebody wiggling their fingers, and nobody sings.
Mm-hmm. There is a real movement in bringing these types of things to festivals, but also bringing them to the home console. And I have a pet theory that I actually wrote about last week in the column, which is that this is basically Sony Boot Camp. And what they're doing to create, you know, extra talent in the future is that they're putting these things into the living rooms of the nation. They're training them on dancing. They're training them on vocals. And then they're turning a switch at Sony HQ, and all the iToys are actually going back into the television.
The problem is, Alex, you're assuming that Sony knows its ass from its elbow.
No, the problem is you haven't read Ender's Game, man. It's not that this is training for a Rock Band. This is the Rock Band.
Hello,
you don't know, but you are actually controlling instruments on the front in the rock and roll war for the galaxy.
Anyway, we'll move on. I think that's just about enough of this conversation. And let's move back to reality. So here is Jemima off stage with the news.
eBay has been ordered to pay €38.6 million in damages to the luxury goods group LVMH for allowing the sale of fake bags, lipsticks and designer clothes. A French court said the auction site must withdraw the goods immediately or face €50,000 in fines per day. eBay immediately appealed. The EU is close to finalising an agreement with the US that would allow the FBI to see the internet browsing habits and credit card histories of UK citizens. Talks began after September the 11th, but the sharing of highly personal travel histories and spending patterns has alarmed civil rights advocates. Mobile operators have reached an EU deadline for cutting text and data roaming charges between European countries. Cuts could reduce prices by 70%, but operators have until 2011 to implement the changes. Condé Nast is to launch Wired magazine in the UK. The 15-year-old San Francisco-based title will launch a UK version in print and online early next year.
Thanks, Jemima. You can read all about it at guardian.co.uk/technology. Glastonbury wasn't the only festival last weekend. In London, the Hide and Seek Festival brought people together playing games in the real world using technologies in mysterious ways.
Over the 2 days, people took part in a real-life first-person shooter, for example. This is my favourite one. It's called Cruel to be Kind, where the bullets were compliments instead of actual live ammunition, and collateral damage left smiles on people's faces rather than the grisly opposite. Also, alternate reality game guru Jane McGonigal, she made an appearance. And throughout the entire weekend, Blast Theory's March of the Figurines performed. Or perhaps we performed and it reacted, or something like that. I met the artists behind the BAFTA award-winning group and began by asking them exactly what it was that they did.
Well, I suppose we make interactive work, artwork, performance work, games, videos. Yeah, artwork that's largely interactive.
And your work is both offline, as in the physical space, and also online. Can you tell me about some of the work that you've done in the past?
Since about 2001, we've made a number of works that are mixing people playing online, in usually in virtual spaces, and people playing on the streets of the city in real spaces, often with handheld computers, and combining those two different audiences of people. Because our background is in theatre and performance work, we've always looked to try and create works where anything virtual is always acknowledging that there is no virtual without the real, that these two realms are actually interrelated, you know, and that it's a kind of artificial distinction to say the virtual world is a completely separate space. Even someone in a complete virtual environment is physically present at the interface of that virtual environment. So we're very interested in how things cross backwards and forwards across that boundary.
And I suppose the two areas that you've been most celebrated for, I think, in terms of winning awards, have been Uncle Roy, All Around You, and Can You See Me Now? Can you explain a little bit about what those were, Jude?
Uncle Roy, All Around You was a game where you went out into the streets of a city with a little sort of PDA, or you could be online, and you had a mission to find Uncle Roy's office. And we tried to get the online people and the people on the street to meet at Uncle Roy's office, to have this kind of meeting of strangers. But you wander around the city with your PDA, you have clues, you go to a real office, a phone rings in a phone box outside, you get picked up in a limousine and drawn around, sort of taken around, and this guy standing in for Uncle Roy basically deals with the contract between you and the online player. This sort of, will you be there for a stranger for a year kind of proposition.
It sounds actually similar to many of the alternate reality game templates that have come forward since that time as well. Do you consider yourselves part of that movement or separate?
I think we're separate for a number of reasons, although there is a strong overlap and we're always really fascinated by what alternate reality games designers are doing. But Uncle Roy, All Around You, it's clearly framed as an artistic experience. It doesn't pretend that it's something else, and it's a work that really drives you to reflect on yourself rather than to kind of engage in a kind of puzzle-like set of activities with a goal of winning a big prize. You know, the prize in Uncle Roy, All Around You is you enter into a contract with a stranger that you will be there for them for the next 12 months. So you end up with this very kind of particular kind of social contract.
What would you say are the technological innovations that have allowed you to explore and express yourselves through technologies?
We've always been really fascinated by how technology is changing the way in which we talk to one another. So the rise of mobile phones, of SMS, for example, global positioning systems, led us to say, well, in what ways are these creating new kind of cultural spaces? Could you think about a mobile device as actually being a cultural space that is analogous to a concert hall? It has many of the same kinds of properties. It is a place where people come together. It could be thought of in those kinds of ways.
You did something for Hide and Seek last weekend, the social gaming experiment that was happening in London and the South Bank. And you're also working with Meltdown. So obviously there is interest in this space.
Yeah.
How are you funding yourselves?
It's always been a sort of real mixed economy at the heart of it. To keep us going, we have Arts Council funding, but that doesn't really fund the project, so that sort of sustains some of the core of Blast Theory. A lot of partnerships, some EU, some UK-based partnerships, commissions. It's a real mixture, and sometimes, you know, we do workshops and consultation work. I mean, that's not the heart of what we do, but that is a part of the beast of the money.
The majority of the funding is about collaborations. For example, Day of the Figurines, which you mentioned, was developed with the Mixed Reality Lab at the University of Nottingham and Sony Net Services in Berlin. as part of an EU research project into games. And so, you know, we're all pooling our resources to try and make something, you know, that's richer and a deeper experience than we could if we worked alone.
I wanted to take a step backwards and understand why you are using the technologies in these spaces. What was, Matt, you mentioned SMS, mobile phones, those types of handheld applications, GPS systems. But what was it really that brought your interest in technology to this art space?
Firstly, because people are using a lot of these tools and it feels like languages or practices that people understand intuitively or increasingly intuitively. In the same way, you know, we know what to do in front of a TV, in front of a cinema, blah, blah, blah. And it feels like a natural thing in the way that you would maybe pick up a book or how you read a painting. People can find their way around those things. I suppose in a way it's a sort of an attempt to reach people through tools that they use in some ways. And I think the other thing is about technology is that I think we are interested in the sort of personalities of the sort of technologies. What are the gaps or things that it's kind of saying or not doing, and how can we kind of find something else? And I think, of course, you can get into sort of technology and in an incredible array of levels, right down to coding and what's the personality of coding and what, you know, who, what's the gender of all of this and blah, blah, blah. But I think as artists, it's our job to look at what's kind of there and sort of slightly repurpose it.
Matt, what do you think are the next technologies that you're going to engage with?
I don't know, but I would say that they're definitely going to be things that are already around us. You know, we've never really worked with particularly cutting-edge technologies. A lot of the work is about how we might link things or conjoin things that would otherwise be seen as very disparate. And that's why we kind of have a foot in the games camp and a foot in art, in the arts world, and a foot in the kind of performance world. Often we're in museums and galleries, sometimes we're showing in games kind of context. So that sort of triangulation is one of the things that really fascinates us.
That was Matt and Jew from the Brighton-based Blast Theory. So location-based gaming, do you think it has legs or do you think it's a gimmick?
I think the problem is, and this happens in lots of forms of gaming that people are trying now, it's hard to see how they can commercialise it and therefore pay for it to happen rather than it just be funded by, say, the Arts Council or something like that. So, you know, it's very nice that you have these events that do these things. But, you know, it kind of be really amazing to play one of these over a long period of time without it needing to be funded by an organisation like that. I think we're a million miles away from that still.
They definitely rely upon the funding. But it is interesting how many people are picking up on their ideas. So March of the Figurines happened last year for the first time. It happened at the Hide and Seek Festival. It's happening at Meltdown as well. There are other products, things like Writer Spoke, that's happened all over the country, most recently at the Brighton Festival. So it seems that they are doing quite a lot of things that are being picked up on. So as it snowballs, do you think that there will be more private funding or that they will eventually be able to fund themselves?
So I kind of understand why alternate reality games are so exciting for both people who create them and the people who fund them. You know, for both of them, that really deep engagement that the hardcore players have with it is both artistically satisfying and commercially intriguing, right? The idea that someone will have, you know, 1,000 points of contact with your piece of media and a whole bunch of different fields. You know, as an artist, it's kind of satisfying. I saw one of the developers of one of Jane McGonigal's colleagues, a guy named Elon, give a presentation where he said they measured success and how many people got married as a result of playing their games, because it's, you know, they're team games and you play over the internet, you meet lots of people, they're very sociable and so on. But they seem to have this, they've got, you know, the production cost of a film and the audience of a novel, which is exactly backwards for running a business. And so you really need to figure out how to turn that around. And the problem thus far, in addition to the cost, appears to be that there's a dearth of people who are really good alternate reality game writers. So you have people like Sean Stewart, who wrote, you know, the Alien game, the AI game, and so on, who in addition to being an ARG writer, is an award-winning science fiction writer. But there are those people are few and far between. And then you end up with some very ingenious puzzle games that aren't very writing intensive, like Tombstone Poker. But it's that I think it's the writing, it's the storytelling that really drags people into it. And we haven't figured out how to put that on a production line yet and make it cheap enough that it's worth doing.
Well, part of the way that some people are doing are making it cheap enough is tying it very closely with the brand. So, for example, you know, the Lost Experience used that particular media and the media partners that were involved with ABC.
But then I think it just feels like a branding exercise. And, you know, I like to play these things, but I don't want to play one that is, you know, that's promoting Coke or whatever. I want to play a game because it's a fun game to play. I think TV's got a massive role to play because there's loads of money in TV. And you know, you can see maybe if you can tie these things together. So what you need to do is a really good way of making each individual bit of media very interesting on its own, and also to network together into this greater morass, which is where the writing comes in, I think. And I think TV is maybe a way to try and shoehorn it in and use the money that you get from a TV commission to spread out, you know, spread it out like Marmite over the toast of the game.
Lost is almost a counterexample, because Lost is already the show that said, like Twin Peaks or some of the others, we're going to go for a smaller audience with a deeper engagement, right? You know, if you're not prepared to watch Lost for an hour every week and spend another 2 hours following up on clues on the internet, you're not a Lost viewer. You can piss off now. And we're going to try and figure out how to sell a lot of stuff to that tiny group of people who are so engaged with us that it's worth it. And I don't know if that group is big enough, right? Especially to justify the production values in something called Lost, and like Lost, and then you add all the production costs of the game and so on. And it's you know, if I were Disney and I had billions of dollars to spend and I needed to figure out what the 21st century was like, Lost wouldn't seem like a bad idea. But in terms of, you know, well, Lost, we're just going to put Lost in a production line and everything will be like Lost. I don't think that's it.
Well, crucially as well, I think ownership has a big part to play in this. You bring up the idea, Bobby, of television. But at the moment, very few television opportunities and content creators are willing to just give their stuff away. And I think that's interesting in terms of what you talk about, Corey, because as an author, you take your writing and your storytelling and you then release it under Creative Commons license. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Well, you know, I've done this since my first book came out in 2003. I was the first novelist to use a Creative Commons license. It was more or less the week that the Creative Commons license shipped, my first novel shipped. And I released it under a license that allowed people to share the book and eventually even relicensed it so they could remix it and play with it. And I've done this with all my books since. Tried, you know, slight variations in the license, but kind of those two freedoms I've always embodied with my books. And it's done really well. And I figured that that there are a lot of good reasons to do this, but the three big ones for me are artistically, it doesn't seem like a plausible 21st century piece of art if it's not intended to be copied, right? It's, you know, it's kind of anachronistic to make something in the 21st century that you don't think people are going to copy freely. It's like making horseshoes or something. That's nice, but I'm a science fiction writer, so I should at least be contemporary if not futuristic. And then, you know, morally, it seems to make some sense to me, too, because we're not going to stop people from doing it. And everything we've tried to stop people from doing it has resulted in these terrible outcomes like spying on people or kicking them off the internet or, you know, suing old ladies and little children for all their money or, you know, none of that stuff seems to make any sense. And besides that, I was an avid copier when I was in the time-rich, cash-poor demographic, too. I mean, you know, I never would have had a single romantic entanglement if it wasn't for the mixtape, you know. So absolutely, you know, if I were 17, I'd be copying everything I could as fast as I could. So it seems hypocritical to say no. And then commercially, like Tim O'Reilly says, I figure my problem isn't piracy, it's obscurity. Of all the people who don't buy my books on a given day, most of them do so because never heard of them, not because someone gave them a free electronic copy.
As an activist, you've been involved with this for quite a long time, and so you recognize that it's very, very difficult to try and convince content creators that, yes, it's a great idea to put things out as Creative Commons. And I'm wondering what their response is, and certainly what how to actually convince them that this is a good idea.
Well, I'm less interested in evangelizing this to people who aren't interested in it. I'm more interested in figuring out how to get the people who look at this and go, okay, well, this makes total sense to me, figuring out how to get their publishers on side, how to do it in the right way. People who do open licensing who want to get commercial remuneration for it, who want to put something out open and then have someone go out and buy a piece of media that's associated with it, they do the open release before the new media is out. So they'll say, oh, well, I'm going to promote my book by making it available online for free for a month before the book comes out. I think this is a terrible mistake because I think the internet attention span is like 8 seconds long. And so people will go and they'll read the first two chapters of your book and they'll go, oh, that's great. I'm not going to finish it on my screen. I should totally go, oh, wait, look, that YouTube video has a guy putting a lemon in his nose, right? And if there isn't one click between, you know, oh, this is great and Amazon will deliver it to you tomorrow, it's probably going to vanish for a substantial number of people. And, you know, I have the advantage of being a blogger for Boing Boing. And because I use my own Amazon affiliate ID when I review things, I actually know to a certain nicety the ratio of people who buy things that are pre-released to people who buy things that are shipping. So if I review something in glowing terms and link to my Amazon to the Amazon sell page with my affiliate ID, if that thing is currently available, I'll sell 10 times as many as I will if you have to pre-order it.
A couple of weeks ago, we had a piece about people who'd put their photos up on Flickr and then discovered that someone had been copying them, selling them on eBay as their own, and making money out of it. And the people who had put these photos up with a CC license, with a non-commercial license, were very surprised by this. What's your take on that? What's the, you know, because these are people who had never thought about selling them on eBay, probably wouldn't have wanted to. They just put the photos up there for people to enjoy.
Well, my suspicion is that the pirates who do this do so regardless of what license is associated with it. It's not like, oh, this one is licensed CC, I can sell it on eBay, but this one says all rights reserved, I won't. My guess is that, and my experience with people who do this kind of sleazy stuff on eBay, is that they just pick stuff that they think will sell and assume that they won't get caught. So I think the Creative Commons license is actually kind of orthogonal to that whole question. Mm-hmm. It's what do you do when people take your stuff and sell it without permission and without giving you any money? And generally speaking, I'm opposed to this, and I think that there are lots of remedies available to you. The easy one is the takedown notice. eBay, if anything, is overzealous in honoring takedown notices. And then if you can figure out who these people are and if it looks like they've got anything to sue them for, the damages available in these instances are substantial. If you're American, it's $150,000 per active infringement. Find a contingency lawyer and sue, but you know, make sure the person you're suing exists in a jurisdiction where you can collect and make sure that they have some assets worth collecting on.
Well, this is something that we'll definitely be focusing on again in the future. And hopefully, Corey, you'll come back into the pod and we can discuss it at great length. But in the meantime, thank you very much. And thanks as well to Matt and Ju. And speaking of creativity, we've just set up a Flickr group, Guardian Tech Weekly, which includes exclusive backstage photos of the Glastonbury performance, plus behind-the-scenes pictures of what we do here at Guardian Towers. Fascinating. This week, we'd love to see what you have to offer. How are you using technology to enhance your creative expressions? Add your digital art to the group, that's Guardian Tech Weekly, or your digital sounds to our Skype line, Guardian TW. Alternatively, you can send them to us, tech@guardian.co.uk. That's tech, T-E-C-H, @guardian.co.uk. Now, Corey, as a blogger, you must have a swathe of feeds in your RSS reader. I can't imagine, actually, how many. You must have about 60 million.
A veritable plethora.
Which ones do you pay the most attention to?
So it's not really a list of feeds so much as a headline style, because I tend to just flip through them really fast. But I'm a big fan of the non-clever headline. When you get 10,000 RSS items a day and you just, every time you sit down at your keyboard, you just hit the space bar and flip through them as quick as you can. The ones that say things like a curious incident, you just don't even stop on. Whereas the ones that say something really interesting like, you know, Robert Mugabe caught wearing women's pants, flip back three and you're like, huh, that's kind of interesting. You open in a tab to go look at later. So it's all down to headline style. I think that everyone wants to write for newspapers, but unless you're writing for actual print where there's some context surrounding it, writing headlines that are just clever instead of descriptive, bad idea, and RSS readers prove it.
The great thing about an RSS reader is you can have a gazillion things in there. And, you know, even if people don't update for 3 months, when they do, you get to read it. And hopefully it's a bit interesting at that point.
That's exactly my top requested feature for an RSS reader, is one that notices dramatic changes in post frequency. RSS is great for the things where you only get one post every 3 months, except that your reader doesn't make a big deal out of it. It treats it like, you know, I subscribe to the Times of India feed, which has got 500-600 items a day, and it's colored in exactly the same way and presented exactly the same way as opposed to the single item that David Byrne posted this month.
Feed junkies all around this table.
Well, I was going to say that's the thing, like probably all of us here are maybe different to other people because most of our job is sharing the information that we find with other people. You know, we tend to take something and build on it and share it, and, you know, it's like CC licensing of information.
Do you have that thing where you meet someone and you haven't seen them for a while and you sit down and you have one of those conversations like you do down the pub and eventually they go, I read all of this on your blog. I was the guest of honor at a Swedish science fiction convention along with a very good British writer named Adam Roberts, who I'd never met. We met in the airport. We were sharing a cab. And we started talking about stuff, and he said, you know, there's a wonderful blog that's about all this stuff called Boing Boing. You should really... Yeah, okay, you read it all. That's all right.
Well, make sure then that you suck on our feed, as it were. I love that
expression.
Which
is now full. We push everything out in full feeds at the moment, and we do want feedback on, you know, I know we've had some feedback from people saying, this is great, some people saying, can we have a partial feedback again, or can we have the option of both? Mm. So if you can email us and let us know, because I'm a full feed fanatic.
I like my full feeds. But anyway,
because then you get searchable feeds. You get your million most recent posts, and they're all searchable. Mm.
Well, you can get those full fat feeds at blogs.guardian.co.uk/technology/games/digital-content. Well, that's it for this week. Many thanks to our esteemed guests, Matt and Ju from Blast Theory, and of course to Corey, Bobby and Charles. We're back again next week on Tuesday. I'm Alex Krotowski. Thanks for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.